Larry Tye joins us on the phone to talk about his book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry Tye runs a training program for medical journalists in Boston. He spent many years writing and winning awards for the Boston Globe. His previous books include Satchel, The Father of Spin, and Superman. That book about the fictional Kryptonian was the work that got him onto the Jefferson Exchange several years ago. So we welcome Larry Tye back to the Exchange. Hi, Larry.
Great to be back with you, Jeff.
Yeah, same here. No secondary figures in your books, I notice. What turned your attention to Bobby Kennedy?
So it was two things. One was, when you grow up like I did in the Boston area, you spend your life infused with things Kennedy. And I went to high school with one of Bobby Kennedy's children, his middle son, David, who was a really tragic figure who died of a drug overdose. And the being with David, having the sense of Kennedys all around me, always had me interested in them. But the thing that really drew me into it was I spent most of my life as a journalist, and my mentors in journalism were some of the hardest-edged guys out there, people like David Halberstam, who won a Pulitzer Prize for the New York Times with his aggressive coverage of the Vietnam War. And I watched one mentor after another fall in love with Bobby Kennedy. The only time people like the people I knew in journalism ever took time off from journalism or ever wrote Valentines as opposed to hard-edge investigative stuff was because they decided that Bobby Kennedy was a politician worth falling in love with. So I was intrigued by the Kennedys, and I was intrigued by what made rhinoceros-skinned journalists love Bobby.
So in that case, as you point out, there's no shortage of bios on Bobby. Did you want to make this less of a Valentine and more investigative?
I wanted to make it fair, and I wanted to do... So Bobby Kennedy started out as a hero of mine. As I dug up more and more about the ways that he was a less than attractive figure, my opinion of him started to falter, and by the end, he remained a hero, but he'd become a flesh and blood hero. So I wanted to do what journalists spend their lives doing, which is looking at the bad and the good and trying to weigh it.
And you claim in the book, it's a great quote here, the classic Kennedy blend of god-awful, disagreeable, and transcendent good. That's quite a blend.
It is, and it's what the blend that, starting with Joe Kennedy, the father, and with all of his kids, they all had things that would make you totally want to bite your nails off in terms of really frustrating things and things that were soaringly good, and nobody captured that. Nobody among the Kennedy clan was more passionate and was a better blend of the good and the bad than Bobby.
The transcendent good, I'm hearing echoes in here of things that FDR heard from his own mother about noblesse oblige. Was that part of it, where when you're born of noble birth or something like it in America, you have an obligation to do good things for others?
You have hopefully an obligation to do good things for others. We've seen, without making this too political, we've seen some wealthy people who are out there today who make gobs of money who may or may not feel a need to give back. And Joe Kennedy definitely infused his kids with two things. One was enough money to ensure that they would never have to worry about money, and the other was this sense that they really did have to give back in very much of an FDR kind of sense.
That was a nice tiptoe, Larry. I have to give you credit for that. So many biographies years after the life of the subject benefit from new info, and it looks like you're in that vein as well. What kinds of things did you have access to?
So it started out in terms of having access to people, and there were people like Bobby's widow, Ethel, who in nearly 50 years had never really sat down with a journalist or an author and talked about her husband in depth. And I'd like to tell you, Jeff, it was because I was more charming and charismatic and showed up and she couldn't resist. But the truth is that I was the guy who showed up when she was turning 88 years old and when she was sensing her own mortality. And I'm convinced it was a question of timing and being there at the right moment. So she sat down for two sessions of a couple hours each, and there were more than 400 people who did that, many of whom were among his closest friends and relatives, his sister, his children, lots of others. And so they, at this moment, gave me an access to things that other people hadn't had. There were about 70 boxes of papers at the Kennedy Library that were newly opened that the Kennedy family had agreed, just as I was doing the book, to open up. There were unpublished memoirs. But the most important thing, so you can have access to lots of new material, and the most important thing is trying to figure out a way, with the benefit of 50 years of hindsight to put his life into some context. And I think having all that time and sometimes being away from the passion of the moment makes it easier to do what I was trying to do. And you or your readers, your listeners will decide whether I did it well, but what I tried to do was not just give you new information, but say, this is the way we understand this guy, and tried to use his life. Anytime you're writing a biography, you're telling one person's story as a lens into a bigger story. And the bigger story in this case was how America was changing from the 1950s to the 60s. And nobody reflected that change and helped steer that change better than Bobby Kennedy did.
And we'll get into how down the road, particularly when we get into Joseph McCarthy. But at the moment, I just want to ask a general question about whether you think that Bobby Kennedy has gotten something like the Camelot treatment that his brother John got.
He did. Nobody got the Camelot treatment that John did, but Bobby, for two reasons, got similar kinds of treatment. One is because he was a Kennedy and he benefited from all the things that John had sort of laid the table for. But the other was that Bobby died, in a sense, even more tragically than John. And any time we lose somebody by assassination, they get a kinder treatment by history. When we lose them on the cusp of their potentially being our president, they get an even kinder treatment.
And Bobby Kennedy, in fact, shot down in June of 1968, just after winning the California primary. I mean, the night of the California primary. A lot of unanswered questions about what his life might have amounted to if it had continued past that point. Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, is the book by Larry Tye, who covered the Kennedy family many times over his years at the Boston Globe. And as you heard, a lot of access to new material here. We'll come back and talk more with Larry about Bobby Kennedy. If you'd like to join us with phone calls and emails, you're welcome to do that. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Larry Tye, who's written several successful books, including one on Superman, for which he visited several years ago on the Exchange. His latest book is a biography of Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, seeks to dispel some of the myths that have grown up about Bobby Kennedy over the years, has a lot more access to the Kennedy family and Kennedy papers than some previous biographies. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about Bobby Kennedy, the brother of the former president, himself shot down in 1968. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the Camelot treatment, which, as you pointed out, was not as much for anybody other than John, but the lingering memory of this liberal in 1968, was that a true image of Bobby Kennedy in total, do you feel?
It was absolutely who he was in 1968. It is not who he was a decade.
Larry, did you go to speakerphone? You sound a mile away.
Sure. I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yes.
Great. Okay. He was the iconic liberal image is absolutely who Bobby Kennedy was in 1968 at the time of his presidential campaign and at the time of his death. It is hugely not who he started out as when he went to work shortly after graduating from law school for the table-thumping, red-baiting Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin. So we have somebody who made a transformation not just from conservative to liberal, but from arch-cold warrior to iconic liberal.
It's pretty crazy when you think about it, and I'm amazed that I didn't know it after all this time myself, but that here's Bobby Kennedy, the exemplary liberal working for the man who gave McCarthyism its name. I mean, and McCarthy was a mentor, I guess a godchild, or they had some kind of relationship like that as well?
Yes, so he was a mentor. He was a great buddy of Bobby's dad, Joe Kennedy, and he was so close that the rumor grew up over the years that he was the godfather of Bobby's oldest child, Kathleen. And Kathleen is very quick to point out to anybody who asks her that that was just a rumor. But it was such a rumor that when I asked Ethel about it, Bobby's widow, she thought it was true.
Really? Wow. Now, but Bobby Kennedy did not stay in Joseph McCarthy's orbit for very long. Why?
He didn't. He stayed there for about 7.5 months, and that was for two reasons. One was that he was an ambitious guy and he was looking always for other opportunities, but more importantly, he worked for a guy named Roy Cohn, the head of McCarthy's subcommittee and a really brilliant young lawyer who was also somebody who hated Bobby and who was a fairly easy guy to hate back. Roy Cohn, for your listeners who are too young to remember, was almost as controversial as Joe McCarthy was. And for anybody more recently who's been following the headlines, it turns out that Roy Cohn was one of the early tutors for a guy that we know of today as a Republican presidential nominee named Donald Trump.
Oh, really? Roy Cohn? Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense. McCarthy himself, was he seen as a rising star in politics at some point?
He was. And again, without getting political, McCarthy's star was rising in many of the same ways that Donald Trump's is. He never made it to be a presidential nominee, but he was one of the most popular politicians in America because it was an era when, so in judging McCarthy and in judging Bobby Kennedy as being a Cold Warrior in that era, we have to remember that in the era of the 1950s, it was very easy to fear the Soviet Union and to fear that there was, in fact, the way McCarthy was saying, a communist behind every pillar at the State Department. It was an era when we were in the middle of a Red Scare, and the guy who was sounding the alarm seemed like a very credible guy at the time.
And lots of political figures built careers on red baiting, Richard Nixon among them.
Absolutely. And Richard Nixon knew when to pull back. Joe McCarthy, partly, I think, because of an alcoholism that ended up killing him, and partly because of just a certain personality, he always took it three steps beyond what anybody else was doing, and that made him get more press attention. It also put him out on limbs that he could not sustain.
Larry Tye is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His new book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. This can be asked of many political figures at many points in their career. Did Bobby fully believe in the mission that McCarthy was on, or did he adopt it because it was the position that was in vogue at the time?
No, so it was definitely in vogue at the time. It was definitely the position of his father, which made it more attractive to him. But most importantly, he believed in it. He said, look, communism is a serious threat, and the only guy in Washington who is taking it seriously is Joe McCarthy. And Bobby continued, partly out of loyalty and partly out of, I think, a misplaced sense of what McCarthy was all about, continued to believe in Joe McCarthy till the day he left his subcommittee.
Okay, so let's back up from Joe McCarthy to Joe Kennedy, his father. You say that Bobby was, of all the Kennedy children, perhaps the most like Joe Kennedy. In what ways?
Well, he started out as being the one that Joe Kennedy had the least use for. Joe Kennedy described him in the early years as being the runt of his litter, which meant not just that he was the smallest, but he was the one least likely to amount to anything. And Bobby then, that set Bobby off on a tangent that lasted the rest of his life, of feeling like he had something to prove to the world, and most importantly, to his dad. And he therefore became most like Joe Kennedy in terms of knowing how to get things done. He was trying to prove to his father that the things that the father valued the most, which was making things happen, were something he could do. And he made happen electing his brother. He was his brother's campaign manager for U.S. Senator. He was his brother's campaign manager for U.S. President. And he was the one that Joe turned to anytime he needed to get anything done, including, and very importantly for Joe Kennedy, Bobby was the one he picked to be executor of his estate. Joe Kennedy ended up having a stroke, and Bobby Kennedy took over managing the family's financial and other affairs.
And yet you call him the most brittle of the Kennedy children. Was it brittle in the sense of their relationship with the troubled relationship with the father?
It was that. It was also the one who, because of the fact that he was this child in the middle somewhere with nine very talented kids total in the Kennedy clan. He was the one who was most sensitive to the underdog in a way that he knew personally what it was like to be the underdog in his family. And he was, I think, the tenderest. And I like to say that if the kids had gone into the church as their vocation, the way their mother Rose would have loved, that Jack Kennedy would have been the Pope. He was the one who sort of rose above things. He was the great intellectual, and Bobby would have been a parish priest. He was down there in the grassroots, really mixing it up, and that meant also being vulnerable and being brittle.
Wow, JFK as Pope. That's a little hard to imagine now, isn't it?
Yes.
So once the parental hope for a career in the clergy had gone by the wayside for Bobby, what were his parents thinking of for a career for him, or what was he thinking about for a career for himself?
They weren't sure. He had been solidly in the middle of his law school class at the University of Virginia. He was somebody that they knew was probably not destined to be a great lawyer. And so they tried a lot of things. He tried a lot of things. Joe encouraged him to try a lot of things, being a Senate staffer, going to work for ex-President Herbert Hoover and running one of the most boring commissions in Washington to try to straighten out the bureaucracy. He tried lots of things, and where he found his greatest strength in his early years was being the lieutenant and, in a way, the consigliere for his brother Jack. And Joe Kennedy had this notion early on that he, Joe Kennedy, ought to be president. And when he blew it during when he was ambassador to Great Britain under Franklin Roosevelt, and when he turned out to be a Nazi appeaser, that ended his chance of being president. So then he decided his son, Joe Jr., would be president. Joe Jr. was killed during World War II in a very brave bombing mission to try to take out the Nazis' V-2 rockets. So then the mantle fell to Jack. And Bobby decided that he was going to devote his life to making Jack a successful legislator and then the most successful president he hoped ever.
Larry Tye is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, former Boston Globe reporter and award winner there. He's written a number of books. His latest is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. You were talking about that being the consigliere for John Kennedy was Bobby's role over time. There was actually more age gap between them than I had remembered, 9 years plus, I guess. Did the death of Joe Jr. draw them closer together?
That didn't, but what did draw them closer together was Joe wanted Jack to take a trip around the world and sort of see how the world ran. He had great ambitions for his son, and he decided that Jack should take Bobby with him. And Jack didn't want to do that. But anything that Joe told them to do, he ended up doing. And they spent so much time together during this trip. And Jack Kennedy got so sick during the trip that it looked like he could actually die. And Bobby helped, stayed at his bedside and nursed him back to health. That it was seeing during that trip to Asia and elsewhere just how good Bobby could be that Jack decided that this was a kid worth something and somebody he ought to bring along in all the great adventures he envisioned for himself.
How crucial was Bobby's work in getting JFK first into the House, then into the Senate, and finally into the presidency?
It was absolutely essential. He did whatever it took. And whatever it took could mean anything from lying to the press and the public about Jack Kennedy's very serious adrenal condition called Addison's disease to helping Jack plot his strategy with all the critical decisions in the election. And if you had a second, I'd love to tell you a story about why I think Jack Kennedy won that election and what Bobby did behind the scenes to make that happen.
Does this involve Martin Luther King?
It is.
Definitely want to hear that story.
Great. So the story is the election's coming down, very, very close election. And most people think that one of the closest elections in American history, that 1960 Kennedy versus Nixon election, was decided by either the fact that Jack Kennedy didn't have a 5 o'clock shadow during their famous televised debate and Nixon looked terrible, or that maybe Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago, stole votes from the graveyard for Jack Kennedy. And those are sort of the myths that have grown up. The truth is, it was, as Dwight Eisenhower would say, it was two phone calls that Kennedy's made. The first was one that everybody knew about back then, and that was a phone call that when Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights leader, was arrested in Atlanta on a really bogus charge. He was sent to jail and then to a state prison. And Jack Kennedy made a phone call from his hotel room to Coretta King, Martin Luther King's wife, and said, "I feel badly about what happened." He didn't say, "I'm going to do anything about it." He didn't do much of anything other than show sympathy. But he got great feedback, and she was really grateful, Mrs. King, for that phone call. What nobody knew until later was that Bobby Kennedy also was making a phone call, and his phone call was one that any lawyer in your listening audience knows was unethical to the sentencing judge. Bobby Kennedy was a lawyer. He was calling, making a private call to the judge, asking the judge if he could let King out of jail, and telling the judge, "Look, you let him out of jail, we get to the White House, and we'd love to have you come and visit in the White House." The judge lets him out of jail. Martin Luther King, on his way out when he's meeting with reporters, thanks the Kennedys. That Sunday before the election, in every black church in America, little blue leaflets went out saying, vote for, well, they actually didn't say vote for. They said, you have a choice now between the candidate with a heart, Jack Kennedy, or the heartless candidate, Richard Nixon. When you look at what happened, election results, the black vote that shifted from the earlier election 4 years before for Dwight Eisenhower, that shifted over from the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, to the Democratic Party, that vote in five states made the critical margin of difference. And Theodore White, who used to write all these books called The Making of the President, mm-hmm. says that it was that black vote that made Jack Kennedy president, that all Richard Nixon had to do was to match his and Eisenhower's black vote from 5 years before, and he, instead of Kennedy, would have been in the White House in 1960.
Well, it seems like it's fair to say, then, based on this, that this that the black vote in the 1960 election probably helped accelerate the push for civil rights in the mid-60s.
It did. It helped change everything in terms of also what the parties looked like. And today, people can't even remember a time when any African-American or many African-Americans voted Republican. But that was until 1960, clear favorite party. It changed our electoral politics, and it changed what happened with Richard Nixon, and he had to wait another 8 years to get into the White House. And it changed everybody's sense, and certainly Jack Kennedy's sense, of just what Bobby Kennedy could pull off and how he was willing to do anything for the result that he wanted, which was to get Jack in the White House.
There's been a lot of dramatizing. We're talking to Larry Tye, by the way, about his book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, here on The Exchange. A lot of dramatizing about the relationship between Bobby Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, who was vice president, became president upon JFK's assassination. I mean, was the animosity as strong as it's been depicted so many other places?
Yes. So there were four people in life that Bobby Kennedy truly detested. We've talked about one of them, Roy Cohn, Joe McCarthy's young aide. A second one was a guy named J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI, and nominally, Bobby was his boss. And Hoover had survived lots of attorneys general, and he wasn't about to take orders from this young kid, Bobby Kennedy, so he hated Hoover. He hated Jimmy Hoffa, the head of the most powerful and biggest union in America, the Teamsters, but the guy he hated more than anybody was Lyndon Johnson, who he didn't want to be his brother's vice president, and then he surely didn't want him to succeed his brother in the White House. And that animosity was so strong, and I think it stemmed from the fact that they were just coming from different worlds. Bobby Kennedy was Harvard, he was Boston, he was Brahmin, and Lyndon Johnson was East Texas and was poor and was, I think, I can't remember what university, East Texas University or somewhere, that he went to school, and they were just so incredibly different. And the sad thing for America is that they both spent the latter part of their political life fighting for issues like ending poverty and ending racial injustice, and had they been on the same side more, they could have been one of the most dynamic and effective teams ever.
Truly. Let's take a call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Larry Tye, the author of Bobby Kennedy.
Yes, my question is, what was the relationship like between Bobby Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover during his time as Attorney General?
Yeah, I've often wondered, you alluded to that just a little bit, Larry, about the fact that in a sense he was actually Hoover's boss, but Hoover didn't take to that.
So can I tell you the answer to that question through a small story?
Sure.
And the story is, when Bobby Kennedy became Attorney General, he understood that he was Hoover's boss, but that wasn't going to be an easy thing to be. And there was a hotline that went from Bobby Kennedy's desk to what should have been Hoover's desk. But in fact, the hotline was on Hoover's secretary's desk. And Bobby insisted that that phone go on Hoover's desk. So when he picked up the phone, instead of having to wait for the secretary to decide whether she was going to put Hoover on the line, he would get the FBI director. And Hoover hated that. And that was a sign of Bobby asserting his influence as Attorney General and as the president's brother, to rein in this guy who had had free reign for so many presidents and so many attorneys general. And that was the relationship that they had until the day after Jack Kennedy was assassinated. And as a symbolic gesture, telling Bobby Kennedy, you no longer matter to me, the day after Jack Kennedy died and when Hoover's buddy LBJ took over as president, Hoover put that phone back on his secretary's desk.
Oh, a little bit of symbolism there, more than a little, actually quite a bit. Larry Tye is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about Robert F. Kennedy, the late senator and late presidential candidate, is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. We'll come back and talk more with Larry, take more phone calls and emails from you about Bobby Kennedy and his life and work when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Larry Tye, a longtime journalist. He's worked for many years at the Boston Globe and won a number of awards for his work. He's written several books. The latest is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, a very detailed portrait of the late senator and attorney general and presidential candidate, gunned down just after he won the California primary in 1968. And remembered fondly by many people today. If you have memories you'd like to share or questions you'd like to ask of Larry, please join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been talking about the time when Bobby Kennedy was essentially in the White House with his brother, JFK, as Attorney General. I've always wondered what the reaction was at the time when the president-to-be says, I'm going to make my brother the attorney general. That hadn't been done before, had it?
It hadn't been. And so the reaction at the time was, what the heck are you doing? I think that there may have never been an attorney general who had less legal experience than Bobby Kennedy. He had never tried a case in a court of law. He was, as I mentioned earlier, in the middle of his law school class, was not a standout in any way. And it was clearly a move that had been dictated by Joe Kennedy, that Joe Kennedy thought two things. One is he thought it would be great for Jack to have somebody who cared and knew him as well as he did in the White House watching his back. And the other thing Joe Kennedy thought is a guy who perpetually skirted the law himself with his financial dealings, it didn't hurt to have his son as the chief law enforcement officer. So that's what he went in under. It was a cloud. It actually spawned afterwards a law that was colloquially known as the Bobby Kennedy Law, ensuring that that kind of nepotism couldn't happen again. Bill Clinton had thought about appointing Hillary as his chief of staff when he was president, and the Bobby Kennedy Law and that experience from 1960 prevented him from doing that. But having said that, Bobby Kennedy went on to amass a record as Attorney General in everything from going after organized crime to promoting civil rights to generally caring about a system of justice and not just a system of prosecution, to the point where I would argue that he was clearly the best Attorney General of the modern era and one of the greatest in the history of America.
I'm curious about how easily the confirmation went. Back in those days, I know the Senate was a little easier on the nominees that the president put up. But this is a fairly brash young guy who, as you pointed out, didn't have a great deal of experience. How hard was the Senate, if at all, on Bobby's nomination to attorney general?
So there were almost no dissenters, and there are two reasons that you could speculate on for that. One is the Kennedy version of the story, which is Jack Kennedy was the president. Everybody liked their young president. It was an overwhelmingly Democratic Senate that was confirming, and that they went along and gave the president his nominee, even if it happened to be his brother. The other story is that it was Lyndon Johnson who did his famous arm twisting on behalf of the new president he was serving, and whether or not he liked Bobby, he liked earning those kinds of points with Jack Kennedy. So whatever the reason was, there was no dissent, and as everything in that era, there were always the Kennedy and the Johnson versions of why.
Let's take another call. We have John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Larry Tye, the author of Bobby Kennedy.
Thank you. I always kind of quote movies, and so Bobby is portrayed in two movies about Jimmy Hoffa. I want your kind of take on apparently there's obviously a feud between Hoffa. One is called Hoffa, it's Jack Nicholson, and the other is Blood Feud, and it's with Robert Blake, and they really do a great job of portraying Hoffa. So anyway, that's my question.
Okay, more than a feud, I think. There were some real legal reasons for going after but Jimmy Hoffa. And how did that play out, Larry?
So it played out in a classic view of what Bobby Kennedy was like in that era. And we're talking the era beginning in the late 1950s when he went after Hoffa as in his role as a Senate aide. And it played out through his being Attorney General when he continued to go after Hoffa in what I think is not incorrectly described as a bit of a vendetta. To Bobby Kennedy, the world was white hats and black hats, and Hoffa was a black hat who he thought was corrupt and who had sold out his union members. And that there was an argument to be made for that, and Hoffa did a lot of bad things. On the other hand, what Bobby Kennedy couldn't see was that Hoffa had built the Teamsters into the most powerful and biggest union in America, 1.3 million members. And the Teamsters adored Hoffa enough that even as Bobby was out there touting all of his mistakes, members were overwhelmingly reelecting him. And Bobby couldn't understand that. These were two guys who actually were hugely alike in terms of their single-mindedness. Hoffa was as tough as Bobby was. The first night when they met, there is the story, which I think is true probably in the Hoffa version in his memoir, that at the end of the evening, Hoffa challenged Bobby to an arm wrestling duel. And it was just, it was the kind of guys these were. They were two physical guys, and neither was going to give an inch to the other. And who won that battle depends, again, on who was telling the story. But it is a wonderful way of looking in his early, tougher years at Bobby Kennedy going after somebody like a bulldog.
So we move a little further into the administration of John Kennedy now and Bobby Kennedy's role in events like the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in that respect, it seems like he was more like the Secretary of State. Was that just a little too far, though, to give a guy like Bobby Kennedy a job as Secretary of State? Did John not consider that sort of thing?
So Bobby Kennedy, anytime something happened that Jack Kennedy really felt that he needed somebody to turn to, whether the issue was domestic, whether it had anything to do with justice, it was Bobby he turned to. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Bobby played a really interesting role. It was partly the role of pushing the debate and making sure that his brother didn't have to be in the thick of things and show his hand, that during all the cabinet meetings, Bobby was the one who was often doing the most talking. On the other hand, Bobby wrote a book that became the defining book and then a defining movie of what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was a book called 13 Days. And at that time, it was the only inside story of what happened. And Bobby portrayed himself in an incredibly self-serving and inaccurate way. He said that from the beginning, he was out there as the great dove arguing for a blockade rather than an invasion of Cuba. Well, the truth is that Bobby started out arguing for an airstrike against Cuba, saying that was the only way to dislodge Castro. The truth also is that for nearly a year, Bobby had waged a secret war called Operation Mongoose to try to undermine the Castro government, and that's why the Soviets put missiles in there to defend Cuba. And Bobby's version of the story might have stood up over time, except that he apparently didn't think the tapes that he and his brother had made of all the cabinet proceedings, the secret tapes, he might have thought those would never become public. They did become public. They became public in a way that it was easy to compare what Bobby had written with what he had actually said in real time, and they didn't match up.
So the way you're telling the story, it sounds like it's possible that the Cuban Missile Crisis was actually precipitated by Operation Mongoose itself.
I think it was precipitated. It was precipitated by a lot of things, and those were Cold War tensions, and it was in an era that this was sort of a natural way that America was going and a natural way that the Soviet ally in Cuba was going. On the other hand, Bobby pushed every button that was guaranteed to exacerbate rather than relieve the crisis. And honestly, on all these things, it's not necessary to believe me. The critical thing is to believe what Bobby Kennedy himself said in his later years, in his more tender and more liberal years, when he went back and admitted all of his flaws, or many of his flaws, in his early years. He admitted that he and Jack were the ones who had helped get us into Vietnam and that he had made a mistake. He admitted that he hadn't pushed strongly enough for civil rights in his early years, and he made up for that by becoming the most trusted white man in Black America by the end. And I tried to use as my standard in judging the early Bobby Kennedy what the later Bobby would have thought of himself.
Let's talk about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because I understand that Bobby Kennedy did not cooperate with the Warren Commission. Did he have any thoughts that there was something deeper than Lee Harvey Oswald? And just what did he say about it?
So I want to answer that question in two ways. One is that Bobby Kennedy never cooperated with the Warren Commission, in part because he was going through such a deep depression himself, and in part because I think he believed there was something more intricate that had gone on than just Lee Harvey Oswald. On the other hand, Bobby knew that he didn't have the real control over the levers of power, and I think he wanted to wait until he was president to potentially reopen that investigation. But as importantly, and I can never prove this, but I know it's true, I think Bobby always had these nagging doubts that left him with an overwhelming sense of guilt, that it was something that he had done that had set off these horrible forces that ended up in his brother being killed. And it might have been his going after Jimmy Hoffa. It might have been his going after Fidel Castro. It might have been his waging a war on organized crime. And I think he always thought that if anybody was going to be assassinated, it was going to be him, and that he might have done something to kill the guy in the world that was his closest friend, that was his boss, and that had given his professional life real meaning.
Was there ever any consideration by either RFK or LBJ of him staying on for very long as Attorney General once John F. Kennedy was dead?
So both of them knew that the gig was up right away, and LBJ was going to let him stay on as long as he wanted to, but was never really going to trust him. And Bobby was going to stay on during the time he was trying to pull himself out of his post-assassination depression, but he knew he really couldn't stay there. And so he eventually found the out of running for U.S. Senator from New York, and that was far enough. LBJ just wanted him out of Washington, and it satisfied both of them and gave them both their own venue to operate until they collided again in 1968.
So the run for the Senate in the state of New York, where he hadn't lived, did he take as much flack as Hillary Clinton did moving to New York to run for the Senate years later?
Yeah, so it's interesting because years later they compared her to him in terms of being a carpetbagger, and yet she, like him, knew that New York was, if it was anywhere maybe outside of Washington, that was an international American city and state, it was New York, and outsiders had, over the centuries, come to New York and made it big there. And so both of them took flack, both of them overcame the flack, and both of them made a home in New York.
How early in Bobby Kennedy's time, I mean, by what point does it appear he made a decision that he was going to run for president? Because, you know, it looks to history like it just sort of popped up because we had LBJ looking like the sure Democratic nominee for 1968. But then he lost the New Hampshire primary to Eugene McCarthy and withdrew in March, at which point Bobby got into it. Was Bobby waiting for 72 or something later?
He was definitely waiting. The idea, there were three things that mattered, three totems to Bobby Kennedy in life. One was his belief in the Catholic Church. The other was his belief in the Kennedy family. And the third was his belief in the Democratic Party. And the idea of trying to upend an incumbent president was anathema to him. And therefore, he hemmed and hawed. And even though it was clear that LBJ was becoming vulnerable in 1968, Bobby didn't want to jump in. Having said that, he jumped in officially 4 days after the New Hampshire primary, which convinced every journalist in America, if not every Democrat, that he was incredibly ruthless, that he was waiting for Gene McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin, to show Bobby's vulnerability, and then he jumps in. The truth is, he had decided to jump in 9 days before that primary, and he was not the ruthless. He was undecided and ham-handed, but not ruthless, and it took him months to overcome that ruthless image, and he finally had done that and managed to convince even the McCarthy supporters that he was the guy to back, and he did that the night of the California primary.
Which was also the night he was shot to death. I want to come back a little bit, though. You mentioned that he was the most popular white man in Black America, and you point out in the book that he had an epiphany during a visit to a shack in the Mississippi Delta. Tell us that story.
So that story is a bunch of senators hear testimony in Washington that there is true hunger in America, and they don't believe it. And they go hold a hearing in Jackson, Mississippi, and they hear a bunch of civil rights workers and others describe to them the way the food stamp program worked back then was you needed a little money to be able to buy food stamps so that you had enough food that you and your kids wouldn't be hungry. Only they learned in that hearing that there were people who actually had zero income and couldn't afford food stamps. All the senators but two fly back to Washington. You know, they take their stories back with them, but they're darn well going to be back in Washington and enjoy the weekend perks of being in Washington. Two senators, one of whom is Bobby Kennedy, say, we want to see what we've just heard. They go for a tour in the breadbasket of America, the Mississippi Delta, and Bobby Kennedy goes into one shack and gets down on the dirt floor of the shack with a little boy with a bloated stomach, suggesting that he was malnourished. And he spends 15 minutes trying to make contact with that kid in a way that no senator before him or after him would ever have done, and this was an epiphany moment.
So many interesting moments in the book and such an interesting life. It was Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon is the book. Larry Tye is the author, joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Larry, good to talk to you.
Jeff, thanks for having me.